Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Judy Herman and I'm at the Rose Theatre in Kingston. I'm absolutely delighted to be talking to David Horovitch after watching him magnificent as Joe in All My Sons in an incredibly moving production of a play that's frighteningly timely, Arthur Miller's play, isn't it?
I think it is. It's a play that's all about putting your business and your family above your fellow man, really. It's about greed and capitalism. And the character I'm playing, Joe Keller, I think would definitely have voted for Donald Trump. And we've started getting laughs in the play since the election, which is only yesterday. For instance, at the beginning, I say I don't read the news part anymore. There's nothing but bad news, and the audience fall about. And then later, a character says, maybe I'll be president one day. And again, they find that very funny, because I think the feeling is that if Donald Trump could be president, then anybody could be president. It's very much a play about a man who, my character, Joe, who really doesn't realise what he's done. He doesn't see the harm in what he's done. And then it's only at the end when he realises that what he's done has made his younger son commit suicide, that he realises how appalling it is. And it has the sort of inexorable quality of a Greek tragedy. And it takes place over a very short time period, from sort of 7 o'clock in the morning one day to about 3 o'clock the following morning, and it's an extraordinarily concentrated play. It starts very light and everything seems fine. They're sitting out in the garden. It's a lovely summer's day, and then gradually it unravels, and by the end it's like a train crash.
Mm, absolutely. Should we just set up what that premise is around which all this, as you rightly say, this tragedy hangs?
Yeah. Well, what's happened is it takes place just after the Second World War, 1946, and I think the first production was 47. It was Arthur Miller's first success. And what's happened is that Joe, my character, ran a small factory or something, and then in the war, this is never stated, but it's implied, his plant was requisitioned to make arms and parts for aeroplanes, and he made a tremendous amount of money out of it, as a lot of American manufacturers did. So the war was a very good time for him. One day a batch comes out of component parts for an aircraft called a P-40, and they have the batch has a little crack in it, and instead of ditching them, he lets them go by, and as a result of that, 21 people are killed, and what makes him further culpable is that he lies to get out of it and implicates a junior partner who has taken the rap and is now in prison. It's tremendously complex as a play, although when you're watching it, it feels very simple. It has the sort of simplicity of a thriller. It unravels like a thriller. And he's lost his son in the Air Force, although his son wasn't flying a P-40, so he knows that his son wasn't killed indirectly by him. And his other son, his older son, is a very earnest young man who is in love with his deceased brother's girlfriend. I think that's kind of enough to be going on with.
But I suppose we should just point out that she is the daughter of the man who's in prison, exactly, taking the rap.
That's very important.
And they used to be next door neighbours, so there's wheels within wheels, everything. Yeah, it's very, very, as you say, when you're watching it, you're quite right. It seems like this inexorable thing is set in motion.
Yeah,
and because, you know, even if you don't know the play, you can sort of see there's some car crash coming, like you said.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I've sort of given away. It's a bit of a spoiler, I suppose, but it isn't a thriller. You know, it doesn't depend on not knowing what's going to happen. I think about halfway through, you kind of guess what's going to happen. But the other thing is that the mother of the deceased son is in complete denial mm. about his death. He just disappeared. He was whatever they call it, missing, rather than they never found the body.
It's missing in action.
Missing in action. So she's never admitted that he's died, and she also knows that her husband is complicit. And it's an open question as to whether the other son, Chris, really knows and is in denial about it. So it's about an enormous number of things with which I think most families are familiar. I think it's about denial, lack of communication, one generation not understanding the next generation. It's also very much about bereavement. It's about the fact that everything is poured into the existing son, and the deceased son is sort of deified as well. There's a scene where Joe just says, God, if Larry wasn't like this, you know, but who knows what Larry was like, really. And then one hears the letter at the end that Larry wrote on the day that he committed suicide, and he realises that Larry was every bit as sensitive and moral as the other son, Chris. I mean, Keller himself is a bit of a rough diamond. He's had no real education. He says, I ain't brainy at one point. But he's got terrific cunning. And he's also got he's very complex, because he's got a kind of sensitivity. He has antennae out about how people are feeling, and he can understand other people's relationships very well, which is one of the things that's made him so successful, I think, as a businessman.
When you're playing him, obviously, you've got to have all that in your head. Mm. You've got to be at the beginning. You've got to be at the beginning of the journey. Mm. You know you've got to... Do you feel that he is constantly haunted by what he's done, or it's just there at the back of his mind, or what?
I don't feel he's constantly haunted by it, no. I think he probably suffers from a kind of what Freud called free-floating anxiety, you know, which he doesn't really know how to identify. You know, he quite often goes to sleep in the middle of the day, and his wife says when he's worried he goes to sleep. Mm. He has ways of coping with it. He cuts out, you know, but he's decided just to move on, and I don't think he really realizes what he's done until right at the end of the play, when he hears his deceased son's letter saying that he's committed suicide, and he's committed suicide because of what his father did. So his father has, in a sense, killed his own son. And it is very Greek in that way, you know.
It's interesting, because I wrote down Oedipus and I wrote down Claudius. I was thinking of all these sort of damaged... Yeah. Fathers or sons.
Claudius, the guilty Claudius. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Isn't he who says something about, oh, I've still got everything that I did it for? I've got my queen, I've got my throne.
Right.
I have
to when he's praying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, he does say that.
It made me think.
I can't remember the exact quote.
But
my prayers fly up, my thoughts remain below.
That's
right. Yes, he does in that soliloquy. But I don't think Joe is as self aware as that, you know. And it's never occurred to him that Larry, knowing what his father did, would kill himself. And then he hears the letter that Larry's written at the very end of the play, and Larry says, if I had him here now, I would kill him. And that's when Joe decides that...
we're not going to say what he does.
It's a very difficult play to talk about without talking about
that. Yeah, because the morals are what it's about.
Yeah, exactly. And it would feel very uninteresting if I just said it's about a play about people sitting in their garden, you know, which is how it starts on a nice day.
But it's got that unity of place as well. It's all set in the garden. And gardens are... There's a lot of baggage that hangs on gardens. There's the American backyard, there's the Garden of Eden, there are a lot of things. There's this tree that's supposed to have fallen down and just on the day that's the anniversary
that's,
of his death.
That's right, exactly.
There's lots and lots of symbolism.
Then the garden is a very, in this neighbourhood, Joe's garden is a place of great hospitality. People just wander in and out of the garden. It's Sunday, they come in and they read his newspapers. He's very generous. He's very, and you also find out that the whole street knows about his. They don't think he's not guilty. They think he probably is guilty. And I have an awful kind of feeling that that's a sort of American thing too. I mean, I've been thinking about Hillary Clinton and the way she said, I misspoke, you know, that was years ago, but it was a euphemism for I lied. And there's an awful lot of that sort of thing going on in this play. Everybody turning a blind eye to things. Well, he got away with it. Great, you know. And, you know, I have much less time for Donald Trump than I do for Hillary Clinton. But I think Hillary Clinton has got away with a great deal. And people have just turned a blind eye. And she managed to become the Democratic nominee for president, even though she misspoke and various other things we know about the emails and all that sort of thing. But people do seem to turn a blind eye to things. You know, as long as you're successful, as long as you're making money, your business is good, and that's Joe's thing. I had a business that it wasn't work. If they found out that I'd done this, they would have closed me down. So what could I do? Well, you could have been closed down, you know.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we might say only in America, but it might turn out to be like Fiddler on the Roof, and Japan, the Japanese might say, oh, it's so Japanese. I don't know. Yeah. To me, it feels very American, but I'm sure it must be universal.
Yeah, no, it does. I think all that kind of corrupt kind of denial is probably much more subtle in Europe and in this country. But in America, it's so much more... It's so much more open, I suppose, because they are very brash. Mm. They're very honest about being dishonest in a sort of way.
As you say, it's this first big success of Arthur Miller's, but to me it's very interesting because it presages a lot of things that have come, you know, like Death of a Salesman and so forth, yeah. But it's a magnificent play on its own. So, and you've got a director who's really worked an awful lot on Arthur Miller, but I think even written about him as Michael Rudman.
I think he's certainly written about him in his memoir. And he worked on. I think he did three productions of Death of a Salesman, and most famously, he did a production with Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, and I think he won awards
in New York. But he also did a production at the National with Warren Mitchell. And he was sort of, I think he was kind of having dinner with Arthur Miller almost every night when they were on tour with the show with Dustin Hoffman. He said that Arthur Miller was a very funny man, which doesn't surprise me. I think there are lots of things about this play that are very funny.
Oh, it's so funny at the beginning, like you said. Yeah. I mean, there are lots of laughs, particularly, you know, the doctor's wife who comes in.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if he's one of these people who comes in for a drink when she feels like it.
Sure. No, he said he was very alive and funny and sexy and not at all a kind of, preachy, moralistic sort of chap. And we were very, very reverent to the text. I don't think we cut anything at all. And I said, "Are we going to cut anything at the beginning?" And he said, "No." He said, "Arthur got so angry with me when I cut half a line of Death of a Salesman." He said, "I wouldn't dream of it."
It's not a long play. You didn't need to cut it.
No, it's 2 hours 20 minutes. No, it isn't, and it doesn't. I don't think it drags at all. Does
not for a second. No. As I say, it's inexorable, really. Yeah. Once it gets rolling.
Yeah, I think so. It's a great thing to do. I'm rehearsing another play next week, which is a bit daunting in our last week of playing this. Can I talk about this other play?
Yeah, go on, mention it, please.
I'm doing a play called All the Angels, which I did at the Globe about 18 months ago, which is a play about the very first production of Handel's Messiah.
Oh.
And I'm playing Handel.
Oh, wonderful.
It's a wonderful play by Nick Drake, and it all takes place in Dublin, where Handel was sort of exiled. He couldn't get his work put on in London. And so he took Messiah, which he wrote in 3 weeks. Isn't that astonishing?
Yes.
and he did it in Dublin, and he needed a soprano. And he tried out this young woman who wasn't really a singer. She was a sort of soubrette. Well, she was a musical comedy star. Called Mrs. Sibber, and it's really the play is really about their relationship, and it's got a kind of Pygmalion kind of element. You know, he's like Higgins and she's like Eliza Doolittle. It's about basically about him teaching her to sing Messiah, and we have a choir of 9 and a 5-piece band.
That sounds gorgeous.
It's gorgeous, all in the candlelit Sam Wanamaker Playhouse. It's lovely, and we do that for Well, we do that for 2 months, starting on December the 4th.
So. Oh, just the right moment of the year to do it. It sounds wonderful.
Absolutely. I should do very well over Christmas, I think. Yeah.
Yes, that's interesting. Yes, being you're in different centuries, different...
I know.
Different time zones, different countries.
That's right.
Yeah, very hard.
That's
yes.
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, we better go back to Arthur Miller, I suppose. Yeah. So, as I'm saying, there's more to... You know, you say Michael Rudman comes with stories and things, but he does, as I say, come with all this wonderful baggage. You must have felt that this was
One of the things about this production, I have never known a director say constantly to the cast, "You're too loud."
Really?
And it was wonderful. He got it, and we weren't rehearsing in the theatre, and I kept thinking, are we going to be heard? And he also said one of the big things he had, which I think is one of the things that really... works in this production is he said, "Don't sell the play to the audience. Make them come to you. Don't you're there. You're sort of behind the fourth wall." And I am of course very aware of the audience, but I'm because of Michael's the discretion with which he directs, I've been sort of less aware of the audience in some ways than usual, and it does feel as though he got us to be very real and very. Conversational, you know. He doesn't like heightened moments of drama that are phony or, you know, he's very, very scrupulous about that.
And I'm guessing that probably that is the best way to play Miller.
I think so. It's the only Miller I've ever done.
Oh, right. Well,
yeah.
I mean, I think mostly I have seen it, as you say, done that sort of way. But
yeah.
It is very natural, as you say. And... you know, your character. It's very interesting. I've read a couple of the reviews. People have mentioned your gait.
Oh right, yeah. I don't read reviews. So.
No, well, they have. They're interested in the when you're creating this character of Joe. I mean, the physicality must be important.
Yeah,
he slightly shuffles around in a slightly interesting.
Yes, it's kind of instinctive. I just think of him as a sort of heavier man than I am.
Yes, you make him heavy.
Something slightly bearish and brutal about him. I never put it. It's the first time I've ever put it into words, even to myself. But now I'm thinking about it. I never think, how does he walk? It's sort of the text kind of dictates that to me. You know, very different from Handel.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I was interested in the number of times that he sort of comes up with what he thinks is a sort of good jokey line, and his son sends him up. I mean, what's that line when you come out and say,
"Oh yeah,
what is this
Labour Day?"
The Labour Day.
It's funny how English audiences laugh at that, because I don't think any of us know what Labour Day is. But I had to find out what Labour Day. But
go on. I'm not sure I know.
Well,
but
I'm
guessing.
I'm not sure when.
A holiday
I'm
where
not sure,
people
yes,
embrace.
It's a holiday where. There is. I think there's a kind of booth where you go and you pay, a dime or something, and you kiss a woman.
Oh right, because he comes on out and
and he says, "What is this Labour Day? Where's the hot dogs?" And he really flogs the gag to death.
He does that more than once, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. He says it about three. He thinks of himself as a joker, you know, and he is quite funny. He's just a bit tiresome, you know.
Yes,
and his son's probably heard all these jokes 100 times.
Oh, you can
times.
Tell that, but I
My
think he's playing it.
Like
let's talk about the rest of the cast. And that's Alex Waldman, who I don't know how you work in rehearsal on relationships, but that's very fine, the relationship between you and Alex and between you and Penny, who plays the wife, Kate.
Well, with Penny and I, we thought that the relationship was very alive and it was still very erotic, you know, and we wanted to convey that, you know, that they were going out to the lake that night and they'd probably have a good time afterwards, you know, in the sack. And there's a kind of feeling, I think, that we have got of a sort of, and that was something we worked on a lot, of a kind of closeness of people went to all, you know, kind of moments when we're all talking at once and contradicting each other and little flare-ups that suddenly become nothing, you know. There's a kind of, with all three of us, I think, there's a sort of, we've worked on having a feeling of familiarity, you know. We understand each other's, not just the way we are, but, I don't think... necessarily we do understand the way we are, but we understand each other's rhythms and patterns and that sort of thing, you know.
And that's very nice, because it's like wheels within wheels. So then we have established that the doctor lives next door and that he's a very upright man and his wife's a typical all-American housewife.
Yeah.
quite daffy, and you know, likes the good life.
Yeah,
she makes that very clear. And then there are other neighbours who've obviously been in, and so he knows all the backstory back into time. But then plop into this comes the woman who now is
Annie,
who now is the girl who's going to be married,
wants
to be married to the surviving son because she's been released by the dead son. But and obviously with the mother in denial, that's a huge part of the story.
Mm.
But what I like about the way it's written is that she comes into the story, and then we know that the son is going, her brother, the son of the man who's in prison, is going to come back. It's heralded and trumpeted. So another, it's like these pebbles being thrown into a, and so the ripples come out into this apparently quiet pool.
That's right. And it all happens in, I don't know what, 17 hours or something like
pretty
that.
Pretty well like the Greek unities. Not quite in the time the play takes.
Yeah.
Very,
yeah,
very,
yeah,
as you say.
Yeah.
All these chickens coming home to roost, I suppose we'd call it, wouldn't we?
Mm.
But as I said, everybody, it's a wonderfully cast production, I must say. I mean, everybody was pitch perfect. And, Anne, I don't know how you pronounce Francesca's name, Zutavella?
Zotavella.
Sure.
Anyway, it's taken me about 6 weeks
yes,
to get
I suppose
that right.
It would. Yes.
I have to think even now. Zotavella.
Again,
she's wonderful.
She's right.
And I feel when she comes on, it's like the stage suddenly
lights up.
She really brings something.
I
think Arthur Miller intended that.
Yes, and it works.
She must have great vivacity and.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone, you know, everyone adores her.
Yes, yeah, she's a life force. That's what I was going
Frank,
to say.
Frank adores her, the guy next door, you know. And, she is. She's a sort of life force.
Yeah. The other thing I found very interesting is that because of when it's set, it's a play of its time. It reminded me a bit of Mad Men, or that, I mean, which is not that far after it, but the woman's place being in the home. I mean, how many plays and films have we seen in America where the doctor's wife, the only way she's going to get the money she wants, I mean, she's not going to go out to work.
She was a nurse.
No,
well,
she had been, but now she isn't.
Yeah, because she's married.
Exactly. So you're married, it stops. And
That's an assumption, isn't it? That was an assumption that my parents made, although my mother did then go out to work when we were about 9 or 10. But most people didn't.
Exactly.
The roles were so clearly defined, weren't they?
And it was this badge of honour that you could keep your wife, and I think that's all there
that's
as
right.
well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yes, there is. And he says at one point, you wanted money, so I made money. What must What must I be forgiven?
I particularly noticed that line.
I've often wondered whether that was an assumption he made, that she wanted money that much, because there's no real evidence that she was greedy or anything. But there's a kind of implication that he had, that this was a sort of compulsion for him. He had to do it, you know.
Yes.
And he
for the sons as well.
Yeah, that's right. He has to leave them the business, and this is his moral duty. And he can't see that being responsible for the death of 21 airmen is something that needs looking into.
Yeah, that negates everything, in fact. There's an interesting... the set is incredibly real.
It's very naturalistic.
It's very naturalistic, in a good way.
I think it is. I feel it's
works.
We can sort of inhabit it, which I very much like, you know.
Yes, we should name check your designer.
Michael Taylor,
yes.
Yeah.
So he's really gone to town on that one. And as I say, but it works.
Yeah, I think it's great.
It really is lovely.
Really,
I mean, I feel good to work on it.
Yeah, I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it. The minute I got onto it, I thought, well, this is home, you know.
Now, I just wanted to mention the fact that you've got a composer, Matthew Scott.
Yeah, very little music.
Not very much, but slightly filmic at times.
Very filmic,
And that was the thinking behind it.
I think so, yes. It feels a bit like, feels a tiny bit like Hitchcock or something in that respect.
Yes. Mostly it's in the background or on track, but then it sort of comes in when there's this big moment, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Do you find that helps? Do you like that?
I'm in two minds about it, to be honest, you know. I'm not sure it's essential to the play.
I think we trust you.
Yeah. I think you can trust the actors, really.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's just round it off going back to Arthur Miller and when he was writing it. According to your programme note, he was very aware of all this sort of thing.
I mean, I don't know a lot about his background, but I know that his father was quite a successful businessman till the crash in 1929. And And so he must have experienced... Mm. I don't know how autobiographical this is, because he writes about it again in Death of a Salesman.
Exactly, that's what I wondered.
You know, the sort of aspiring businessman who's for some reason failing, you know. And it must have had something to do with his relationship with his father, I think.
He does keep coming back to those relationships.
He does,
doesn't he?
Yeah. Yes. Well, View from the Bridges of Father and a Daughter, yes, of course. But
you did mention intergenerational at one point. Mm. And I think that's there, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yes.
And isn't it Death of a Salesman, it's the one where he had to move from somewhere posher to somewhere less
that's
posher.
Right.
That definitely happened to Arthur Miller.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
just finally
very much so.
Rounded off. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't think he was ever sort of desperately poor in the 30s,
no,
but I think they had to really, really come down. They really came down in the world.
Yes, I think that's the point, isn't
and
it?
And I think
yes.
Arthur Miller must have observed what that did to his father.
Yes,
you know?
And I think that's his writing.
That feeds a lot of his writing.
And there's one last point then, that... this isn't a Jewish family, it's an all-American family, and not that many of them are, but, of course, he is from a Jewish background.
I talked about this with Alex, who plays Chris. Alex is Jewish.
I know,
I'm
and so are you.
Jewish. I'm
yes,
only
half.
Jewish on my father's side. And we said, do you think they're Jewish? And I said, they can't be Jewish, because you're called Chris, you know.
Yes. I noticed that. I said that to myself.
And he talks about Jesus and crucifying. And there's a whole, all the eschatology, all the terminology is Christian. Mm. I said, they're not Jewish, but the cadence is
the
Jewish.
Cadences
you
are.
Cannot get away from it. Arthur Miller writes Jewish plays.
He does.
You know?
There's a repetition thing. I can't remember exactly where you... And you sounded very Jewish when you said it.
Oh, right, yeah.
Particularly your character, written with those Jewish cadences.
Yeah.
And so I think it's kind of...
I think he just... That's the way he wrote, you know. I think he was... View from the Bridge is an Italian family, but they sound Jewish
they
to me.
They do. And I was only going to say also that Michael Rudman, he's Jewish too, so possibly it's ideal director.
Yeah.
So, totally fascinating play that we could talk about all day and all evening, but you've got to do it all over again later.
I'm just going to say...
Thank you so much,
Dave
Horowitz, for talking to me.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the show.
About this play for Theatre Voice. Thank you.
Thank you.